Yeah, all right. The English, Rabbi Sheikh, last week, the verses that you were reading that were translated anger, in the English, in our English version, they're translated sorrow. And, of course, you miss several times.
Which verse was that?
All right, which verse was that, Jeff? If you looked it up, that was Jeff King. There were several. I noticed that in Ecclesiastes 1:8, I believe, then. And several of the verses, I think almost every one that you gave, it was where you said anger, it was sorrow.
1:8 is not one of the verses.
All right. Marvin, that was not one of the verses. All right. If you got any of them, I can't even... Ooh.
You're talking about. The last verse.
Yeah, 18, okay.
Now, what is your translation?
All right, I'm flipping over there right now. It says, for in much wisdom is much grief.
Nope.
He that increases knowledge increases sorrow.
The last word is right, sorrow. But it says, with much wisdom is much what?
Grief.
Grief?
Yeah,
no.
G-R-I-E-F.
No, that's not the translation. The word is kaas, which means anger. And let me see how they translate the other verse that I mentioned, which was...
which one, Marvin? 7:3.
7:3.
Yes.
And they translate grief?
Sorrow is better than laughter.
No. There it says... there it's also anger. What about the other one where he says remove... anger from your heart.
It's sorrow.
Does remove sorrow from your heart?
Yeah.
That's absolutely wrong.
11:10. It says remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh.
Nope, that's wrong.
Okay. All right, so that's...
Which one? Is that the Jerusalem translation?
No, this is the basic King James, but the...
Oh, yeah, I'd like to see what the Jerusalem translation is.
Jerusalem translation. Jim Long, where is he? All right, you got your Jerusalem translation. Ecclesiastes 11:10. I didn't bring my GPS with me tonight. I usually have it with me. It says sorrow. Yes, also, Rabbi.
In 11:10?
Yes.
That's strange.
Well, see, this is a thing that I've said about the GPS. We've had classes on this here. And the GPS, with few exceptions, is a basic King James translation.
That's pretty bad.
It is. And that's the reason I pushed the JPS for a while, and then I started doing a comparative study, and in most cases it's no better than the King James, except it has the Hebrew text, and you can look over on the face and page and get the Hebrew text from it. So.
Well, that's it. What can I tell you?
Well, we need to learn that. Right. When the Messiah comes, we'll get him to give us a cram course.
That's it. I'm sure he will.
All right. But we are learning a little along. So, okay, so you can take up from there.
Okay.
All right. And we've been rolling for this 5 minutes or so. All right.
Okay. The point that I wanted to make last week, and I think it's probably the most important point in understanding Ecclesiastes, and that is that the nature of his questions, okay, the questions that he's raising, from a unique point of view. It's not the question of a religionist. It's not the question of a philosopher. It's the question that only a man like Solomon could ask, because he is armed with the prophetic knowledge, and simultaneously he looks at events that don't support the basic theme of does not support the basic theme of the knowledge. Now, a philosopher can never ask such a question, because every question is something true or is it not true. Either he can prove it, in which case he has no doubt, or if he can't prove it, he has no problem with it. It's just something which he doesn't know. Again, a religionist, on the other hand, doesn't raise questions for a different reason, because man-made religion is basically nonsensical. It has to be because it stems from the emotional part of man's makeup. And emotions don't talk reasonably. People try to interpret their emotions into reason, but when you put them to the critical test, it's just not going to work. So the religionist chooses to ban questions or to turn away from questions or to twist reality to satisfy himself or herself. Okay, I heard recently that Nancy Reagan said that the fact that her husband has Alzheimer's is a blessing in disguise. Why? Because now the family is getting together. Well, a real blessing is to get together in good health. But even if I should say that even if I should forget about that point, the question would, of course, be what is better, to lose your family or to lose your mind? I think that any intelligent person would say, well, if I have to lose, I don't want to lose, I may love my family, but my mind, if I lose my mind, I lost everything. So there again you have the typical approach of people trying to say everything's a blessing. Everything's a blessing from God, and trying to twist reality to satisfy their emotional needs. That is not the philosophy of Torah. Torah calls a spade, and Torah never twists anything. Okay, because Torah is the study of the true religion, that we know the facts from the practice, and we're obligated to pursue with our minds the understanding of these ideas, and not to sweep anything under the carpet. We're not afraid of questions. We have certain things we don't understand, but we certainly do not twist reality. There's never, in Torah, we never find any kind of virtue in twisting reality to conform to a religious principle. That is not the virtue of Torah. We're very honest, and if we don't know, we don't know. But what I want to make clear, and I know this is a difficult point, but I think it's the most important point in the entire thing, and that is the basis and the type of question that he's asking. You see, he is not questioning the facts of his faith, because those facts he knows from prophecy. What he seems to be questioning, and I'll show you this at this point. We have to just take it tentatively. I'm going to modify it later. But in order to explain it, I have to put it in a certain clear way that I'm going to modify later. Okay, the point is like this: that what he's doing here is he's asking certain questions. He's showing that reality does not conform, or would seem not to conform, to any principles even of his faith, which means even things which he knows to be true, reality doesn't seem to conform to it. Now, again, when I say, and now I'm going to modify that a bit, when I say doesn't conform, I don't mean to say that he sees things in reality that contradict his faith. That's not true. Because any person that would see things in reality that contradict his faith would be hopelessly lost, according in the faith of Torah. Because the faith of Torah is based on reason. Now, if your reason tells you A, and your eyes tell you B, and then you're stuck. You simply go. But Torah tells you eyes is something that reason tells you to accept as what you see as being true. The whole event of Sinai was something which was visual, observable. Torah starts off with the foundation that we accept the senses, and we accept the mind. So if you have something from reality that destroys the principles of Torah, then your system, belief system, according to Torah, is impossible. Okay, and Torah maintains that there is nothing in reality that contradicts any of the ideas of Torah. All right. So that being the case, we come back to the question of: so what is he asking? Okay, what is he asking? If that's the case, and what is it that contradicts the ideas of Torah? All right. So what is his question then? All right. And this is the point I'm trying to get across. His question is like this. His question is based on psychology. In modern terms, we would call ego psychology, okay? In psychoanalytic terms, we call ego psychology. Now, ego psychology means that man must function in a certain way. And the way he functions is that there is a lot of energy that is driving towards a certain kind of satisfaction that he must satisfy in order to function, okay? Now, what Ecclesiastes is showing is that in reality, if a person were wise, he would not be able to function neither in the lifestyles of the secular world, which are non-religious world. He would be defeated in that type of a lifestyle. And even, he goes further, even in the lifestyle of the religious world, he is also going to be defeated. Now, when I say defeated, again, I don't mean to say that Ecclesiastes is showing something which goes against his principles. Then, of course, he would be defeated even according to Torah. Of course, according to Torah, your belief system has to be based on knowledge, and if you have contrary knowledge, then you're just stuck, and that's it. You're just gone. But we maintain, of course, that there's nothing in reality that contradicts Torah, and there isn't. So now his question, however, is not a question that what he sees in reality is against Torah in a logical sense, but it is against Torah in a psychological sense, and it's against any kind of lifestyle in a psychological sense. What do I mean by a psychological sense? By a psychological sense, I mean that a person's psyche is constructed in a certain way, and in order for a person to function, his psyche must be capable of a certain type of satisfaction. If he doesn't have that kind of satisfaction, he simply can't function. Because man is, interesting thing about Torah is that Torah blends psychology and philosophy, and philosophy and psychology are really one in Torah. In a modern day university, these two subjects are separate. They're treated as if they're two separate things. Torah maintains that cannot be done. Psychology and philosophy have to be combined, and that is really the uniqueness of the Torah approach, is that it combines both of those sciences. Now, what Ecclesiastes is saying, just to give an example, is any lifestyle you take, if you will be honest, will be defeated. Okay, and that's what he means by the verse I mentioned last week, 1:18. He says, because with more knowledge, there is more anger. Okay, and he who increases his knowledge increases pain. On the other hand, he states many times that knowledge is the greatest thing, and knowledge is something which gives you life, and which would seem to be a contradiction. But it's not a contradiction. Again, his method of contradictions, and we will take that up, all the contradictions, and show you that how from the contradictions, if you study them, you really understand his ideas. That's his method. His method is contradiction to alert you to some insight. Now, over here, what he's saying is like this. He's saying, with more knowledge is more anger, which means anger, we explained over here, is philosophical anger against reality, because reality doesn't conform to what you want. And he says, he who increases his knowledge increases there, the word is sorrow, is correct, or pain. Literally means pain. So if you increase your knowledge, you increase your pain. What he means is like this. What he means is that if a person, let us take the lifestyle, for instance, the one that he takes first, which is a secular lifestyle. And again, the philosophy of Torah is that one must study and one must investigate. If it was just a simple religion, you wouldn't need Ecclesiastes. Okay? But Torah demands not to sweep anything under the carpet. Now he says over here, he says, he writes in the beginning, in 2, he starts talking about how he himself built up his houses, his palaces, his gardens. That's Ecclesiastes 2, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, okay? And finally, in summation, he said he had money, he had servants, he had beautiful brooks, and he had his own private beautiful gardens and woods and anything a person can dream of, and all kinds of enjoyments and all kinds of treasures. Okay, that's what he expresses in these verses. And in 9, he says, and I became more great, and I increased more than anyone before me in Jerusalem. Okay? And he says, my knowledge stood by me. And then he says, in other words, what he said, the reason why he says knowledge stood by him is because what he's saying over here is that he was an individual who was able, a rare individual, who was able to perform an experiment on himself. In other words, he studied himself, and he studied his own mind and his own emotions and how these things affected him. You see, most people cannot do that. Most people's emotions and their mind are the same thing. They can't distinguish between one part of themselves and another. But Ecclesiastes is saying, he says, no, my knowledge stood by me in spite of my indulgence in these, how these pleasures are affecting me and how my psyche, how my mind is working. Okay? And then he continues in 10 and he says, everything that my eyes wanted, I didn't refrain. I didn't refuse them. And I didn't my heart from any kind of happiness because my heart was happy from all my work. And he says, and this was my portion. This is what I got from all my work. And then he says, in other words, what he's saying over here clearly is that he wasn't the person that was incapable of happiness. There are people that just can't enjoy things. You know, I mean, basically, no matter what happens, they're incapable of pleasure. That, according to Torah, is a sick individual, an ascetic, a person that just can't enjoy life. That's a sickness. The Jerusalem Talmud states a person that can't enjoy something, then there's something wrong with them. The Torah does not consider that to be a good thing. If a person by nature should be able to enjoy life, should have a psyche that's capable of enjoyment, you'll find the deeply religious psyche, what the world calls as religious, is one who is incapable of physical pleasure. This is a defect, not a virtue in Torah. And that's what he's saying over here, where he states that I didn't prevent my heart from any kind of happiness. And he says, because my heart was happy from all its work, that's in verse 10, 2:10, and this was my portion from all my work. In other words, his enjoyment. He was able to enjoy everything that he had. He didn't have any psychological problems, in other words. Okay? Then he says in 11, and I turned to look at all the actions that I did and all the work that I... all the effort and work that I exerted to do, he says, and behold, everything was nothingness, frustration, and there is nothing extra, so to speak, nothing worthwhile under the sun. He's saying he's put a lifestyle of the empire builder, and he's saying that the empire builder, if he were really honest with himself, he would see that all the effort and all the work that he does, even though he may have these pleasures, these momentary pleasures, first of all, these momentary pleasures don't equal the pain and the effort that he has to put into it. If he were really honest, he would see that it is not a worthwhile endeavor. The effort, the pain, exceeds the pleasure tremendously. That's number one. Number two is the satisfaction that a person receives from these things, even if he's psychologically sound and healthy. Satisfaction is momentary. It is something which does not have any kind of lasting effect on the person's psyche. And the person, in a short time, just looks at what he has and just thinks it's nothing. In other words, the person who lives, and put it in simple terms, the person who lives in a $100,000 home and the person who lives in a $1 million home, these two people, there is basically no difference. In other words, the excitement of the $1 million home and the striving for it and the work and the effort that's expended and that's put into it, the pain and the effort that goes into it, far end, that's one, and two, the pleasure is very short-lived. And in a short time, the person does not realize where he's living anyways, and he just went up one step. But now, in terms of his psychological energies, he really is no different than he was before. And in other words, the person gets used to these things very quickly, and it's all nothing. So a person can never think to himself that this is really something great. And again, he's psychology, which is that man is always looking for something great. Man isn't happy with the practical. That's not something that's going to make a person happy. A person wants to be great, whether he wants to be a great hero, a great politician, or something great. But in his mind, he has to feel there's something great. And this is where he shows that the physical pleasures is one of the lifestyles. He goes through every single lifestyle. But this is This is one of the lifestyles where he's talking about the accumulation of wealth. Just for its own sake, for the enjoyment of wealth, and thinking that this is truly the great thing in life. What the world is saying is that to think that way is impossible. The only one that will think that way is a fool, not an intelligent person. because a fool will always delude himself and will always underplay the things that he doesn't want to see. But if a person were really honest, he wouldn't do that, and he would see that it really is worthless, and all this effort and all fantasy. The fantasy that he built up about this thing is never the reality. The reality isn't even an important percentage of the fantasy. So the end result is frustration, okay? That's basically what he's saying. That's why he says that the person who has more knowledge has more anger. Anger, again, being defined as when a person is unhappy with what he sees. So here he shows that this has nothing to do with religion, you see. It has to do with analysis of life. And the Torah demands we analyze every lifestyle. Even the lifestyle of the wicked man has to be analyzed. Now, over here he's just taking the lifestyle of the pleasure seeker, okay? And he's showing that the pleasure seeker's fantasy and the work and the effort and the anticipation is tremendous, and the gain is short-lived, small, and leaves him in a state of frustration. Okay. But then he analyzes other lifestyles, and including the religious lifestyle. And he shows that even the religious lifestyle has its problems. Now, again, the reason why I'm bringing this in, I will go through some of the lifestyles, but why I'm bringing this in is to show you exactly what I mean by the nature of his question. His question is not that there's something out there that destroys the principles of Torah. That's not his question. His question is, can the Torah life be a psychologically satisfying life based upon the principles of human psychology? Because if a life is supposed to be a good life for a person, it's got to work, and it's got to be psychologically satisfying. And here's where he shows that the lifestyle of the Torah life has problems as well. And this is where he says, for instance, let me show you, where he says, for instance, just give me one second. Yeah, where he says, for instance, the lifestyle of the wise, which is right following, right at 2, we left off at 2:11, where you get, there he's finished with lifestyle of the pleasure seeker, the Sybarite. But then take a look at the lifestyle at 13. He says, we're at 12 and 13, where he says he studied wisdom, and he also studied the lifestyle of the wise and the lifestyle of the fool, okay? And then he says like this, he says, and I saw that there's tremendous benefit, the benefit of light to darkness. And then he goes on to 14. The wise man, his eyes are in his head. In other words, means to say that he sees what's happening. He understands reality. That's a different kind of a life. He says the fool walks in darkness. He doesn't know what's going to happen to him. He has no concept of what's around him. He lacks knowledge in every way. So you would say from this, say, okay, so forget the lifestyle that you mentioned before, the lifestyle of the pleasure seeker. Yeah, that's all frustration and fantasy. And when the time comes, the satisfaction is never even any sizable degree of in terms of the fantasy, okay, and the illusion. So you're left with frustration. Fine, let's leave that lifestyle. Let's take the lifestyle of the wise. Now here we have something that's fantastic. Wisdom. What is greater than wisdom? Nothing is greater than wisdom. Everybody will agree that knowledge and wisdom is something that is the greatest thing man has. Okay, it's great in every way. It's great in your practical life. It's great in terms of understanding science. It's great in terms of producing the technology. It's great in terms of understanding the universe. That's the greatest thing possible, right? So he says, and the fool is like an animal, basically. He has no knowledge at all. So he says that's right. That's what he expresses in verse 14. But then he says, and I know at the same time that one occurrence will occur to both of them, to all of them. And he's seen. And I said in my heart that the occurrence or the fate of the fool will happen to me too. And why did I then become wise? What gain did I have in becoming wiser than somebody else? And I said in my heart, this too is emptiness. Okay? And then he goes on to say that the wise man, he says that the, um, he says that the, that the, um, terms of remembering, he says there is no memory, there's no remembrance for the wise man and the fool. And he says everything's forgotten after a while, whether you are wise or whether you are a fool, the whole thing's forgotten after you die. And he says, and how is it possible that the wise man should die with a fool? This is one of his big questions. In other words, his question is like this, that if you're going to psychologically, if you're going to, and philosophically, if you're going to say that there's something worthwhile in this life, in this human existence, then you'd have to say it's wisdom and knowledge. I mean, an intelligent person would say that. That's greatness. That's man. And Albert Einstein, who understands the universe, that's a great man. Okay? A great Torah scholar, a person that has knowledge of God's works that were given through prophecy, that's a great man. Okay? Who's going to deny that? Nobody in their right mind knowledge. But he says the truth of the matter is that knowledge, when a person thinks of knowledge in psychological terms, a person is awed by knowledge. There's an awe. There's an awe to be standing in the presence of an Albert Einstein. And you know, there's a blessing that we have to recite when you're in the presence of a great scientist, because it's an awesome thing. And but he says, but there's only one problem with that. The awe takes this great person and raises him to something above everything else. If you want to be honest with yourself, you can't equate an Albert Einstein with a total idiot. I mean idiot. I don't mean psychological, pathological terms. I mean in clinical terms. I mean an idiot, a fool, an average fool. How can you equate these two people? Well, one man's mind is keeping track of his day. I mean, it's like silly. You can't compare the two. Okay. But then he says, but if that's the case, there's something that's very disturbing about that too, because they both die the same way. Now, anyone that is honest with himself would say that if wisdom is really so great, and a human being that is on a really great intellectual level, plane, that such a human being, it should be expressed somehow. Somehow it should be expressed in his life, in his physical existence. I mean, if God made the world in line with human wisdom, and wisdom is the most important thing, and you can't compare the life of a wise man to the life of a simpleton who basically lives on a level a little bit higher than the animal, how you can't compare these two lives, then there should be some kind of a difference. Nature should express itself differently towards these two people. The wise man shouldn't die like the fool. There should be some difference. Maybe he should live twice as long. I don't know. Three times or whatever it might be. But certainly he shouldn't be prone to the same fate as a fool there. If you're going to tell me that wisdom is really the greatest thing, okay? Now, again, the Ecclesiastes is based